broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network. This is Cultural Baggage.
Not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. We invite you to join us as we examine the unvarnished truth about the drug war. This week, as we approach the third anniversary of the debacle of September 11th, we'll take a look at the war of terror and the war on drugs and their interaction and their symbiotic nature. Among the guests you'll hear today are Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. You'll hear from John Conyers, U.S. Representative. We'll hear from Canadian barrister Eugene Oscapella about the war on terror. We'll hear from Cele Castillo, a former DEA agent and author of Powder Burns. We'll hear from Al Giordano from South America and Narconews.com. And we'll hear from Judge James P. Gray, who's now running for a U.S. Senate seat in California. But first up, let's hear from the senior editor of Reason Magazine, Mr. Nick Gillespie.
As we approach this anniversary of September 11, I see many parallels between the war on drugs and the war on terror, and I'm wondering if you see much the same.
Yeah, there are a couple different ways that these things intersect, but let me just point to two. One is that the war on drugs and the war on terror are both what I call structuring events in American life, in that they end up becoming background to everything that we do in society in ways that are similar to the Cold War, where, for instance, so the drug war, you see the drug war is built into grammar school curricula. It's built into video games, where we used to have, at the end of video games, a message would come out and say, you know, real winners don't use drugs. At almost every moment and in every aspect of American life, there's a moment where people stop and deliver some kind of anti-drug message. Something similar is going on with the war on terror, where it, like a kind of tamped down or a junior varsity version of the Cold War, has become a structuring event where everything that we do, whether we're talking about going to a football game or taking an airplane ride or leaving the country, you have to pay attention to the war on terror. So in that way, I think there's some similarities. In a more concrete way, one of the ways in which these things have intersected is that a number of drug warriors, people who have been in high governmental positions in terms of fighting the drug war, have shifted into the Homeland Security apparatus. And for instance, Asa Hutchinson, the former head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, is now Undersecretary for Border and Transportation Security within the Department of Homeland Security. And another ex-DEA chief, Robert Bonner, is Commissioner of the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection there. And John Kerry, the Democratic candidate for president, has already told us that he wants Rand Beers to become his Homeland Security advisor. Beers is a drug warrior who was involved in both the Clinton and the Bush administration.
Well, that brings us full cycle to the original reason I called you. There's an article in Reason Magazine. This is Kerry on drugs, and it speaks about Rand Beers and Kerry's history in supporting a further war in Colombia and so forth.
That's right. Well, you shouldn't. I mean, this is one of, if you care about the drug issue, if you care about drug legalization, if you care about fairness towards people who use drugs and medical marijuana and things like that, this election is particularly frustrating because you don't have, between the major parties, you don't have a clear choice of a person who will be better about the drug war than the other. And this also goes back to the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration was as bad as the first Bush administration on the drug war. And in many ways, the George W. Bush's administration is merely following up on a number of policies that have been put into place by the Clinton administration, including domestically going after medical marijuana clubs where they have been made legal through state law. John Ashcroft is doing nothing that Janet Reno didn't do when he's threatened cannabis clubs. And then internationally, or in terms of foreign policy, the Clinton administration put into play Plan Colombia, which was a crop eradication and a coca reduction program that has had very little effects other than to really hurt subsistence farmers. And the Bush administration has pursued that as well. And Rand Beers, who has again been named as Kerry as his advisor for Homeland Security, was one of the architects of that plan.
The other day I read that John Edwards is suggesting to double the investment in the anti-drug campaign in Afghanistan from $120 to $240 million as one of their solutions.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that isn't an indication that they just don't see the full picture yet, that they're actually funding these terrorists by increasing the prices.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that is particularly frustrating about foreign policy when it deals with the drug war is that there is a sense that somehow by doubling down or tripling down on the amount of prohibition that you will somehow, you know, break the back of international drug traffic, whereas in fact all you do by making it more difficult in order to grow or to trade drugs is that you make it more profitable for the black market, which increases the violence and increases the degradation that goes along with any illicit trade, whether you're talking about illicit trade in spices or in drugs. And there is absolutely no recognition of that fact on the Kerry team. And, of course, we've had 4 years of a Bush administration to show that they're not interested in that either.
Nick, if there's one thought that you'd like to relay to my listeners about this situation, what might that be?
Well, it's extremely frustrating that in the current political climate, among major parties, there are virtually no voices that actually make the case that people should be allowed to ingest what materials they want and then live with the responsibilities for those choices. But there's nobody saying that. And even if you don't believe that, if you believe in cost-benefit analyses of public policy, there is nobody out there making the common sense case that the war on drugs, both in its domestic and its foreign versions, is absolutely destructive of everything that it seeks to make better. It increases crime, it increases violence, it increases addiction, or more importantly, perhaps not it increases addiction, but it increases the difficulty in seeking treatment if you have a substance abuse problem. So it's a complete failure, and yet there seems to be very little interest among the major parties in addressing this issue, which again has become a structuring event of our time, so that you can't even watch a kid's TV show without getting some kind of BS drug war propaganda involved in it.
Nowhere is the symbiotic nature of the war on drugs and the war on terror more obvious than in Afghanistan. And here with our weekly Poppygate report is Glenn Greenway. Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
In June, President Bush called Afghanistan the first victory in the war on terror. The L.A. Times reported last week that 200,000 acres of opium were cultivated in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan last year, approximately the size of New York City. Drug experts believe terrorist groups earn money from the U.S.-Afghan opium crop and channel $120 million a year to Islamist groups in Uzbekistan and Chechnya. Chechen terror attacks in Russia have claimed more than 400 victims during the last 2 weeks alone, including at least 150 children. Radio Free Europe, Reuters, and the Baltimore Chronicle have all recently reported on the growing problem of child abduction in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. Children from all over the country are being kidnapped and taken abroad for sexual servitude, slave labor, and illicit organ donation. Columnist Jane Stillwater puts it this way. Since the American takeover of Afghanistan, the major crops there are now opium, human organs, and children. As always, this is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Paper ballots, electronic voting machines, will it make any difference in those coming elections? Let's ask Al Giordano.
What people in Latin America are all wondering is, well, will Bush try to steal the next election too? And if he does try to steal it, what will the response of the American people be? Will they take it lying down like they did in 2000, like Al Gore and the Democratic Party did in 2000, or will they stand up and fight Bolivian and Latin American style pro-democracy tactics and strategies to win back your democracy.
Okay, we heard from south of the border. Now let's hear from Canada and Eugene Oscapella, a Canadian barrister who presented a report on terrorism to the Canadian Senate.
I guess that one of the big points, and it's something we can't forget, is that terrorists need money. And they get money through the drug trade, but the reason the drug trade is so profitable is because we persist with this whole issue of prohibition. The drug trade would not be financing terrorists if it weren't for prohibition. That's a very important point that we sometimes risk losing in the debate about drugs and terrorism. It's not drugs that finance terrorism, it's drugs under a system of prohibition. Our governments have decided to prohibit drugs. When you prohibit them, it creates a very lucrative black market, and that is what is financing the terrorists. So ultimately, we've got to move away from prohibition if we want to seriously get rid of some of the financing that's helping terrorist groups around the world. Now, on the whole issue of the similarities between the war on drugs and the war on terror, if you look at both of them, the standard governmental response has been to go after drugs and to go after terrorism through police action or military action, in other words, using violence to combat these things. We rarely ask why people use drugs. Instead, what we do is we punish them. We use the might of the law, the might of law enforcement, our criminal justice system to go after these people. And we're doing exactly the same thing with terrorism in a lot of cases. We're not asking ultimately the question that we need to ask if we want to protect ourselves ultimately from further terrorist acts, and that's why do people commit terrorist acts? Ultimately, at some point we have to ask, and at some point you need to use force, obviously, in the immediate aftermath of an act like that, but at some point you also have to ask, just as we need to ask about drugs, why do people use drugs? We need to ask, why do people get mad at us? Why do people want to kill us? Because unless we ask that, we're not going to solve anything. So it's a failure to look at some of the underlying causes, I think, that hurts us on both these accounts. And in both cases, what we're seeing now with the war on drugs and the war on terror is the use of extraordinary police powers, you know, new powers of search and seizure and new intrusions onto privacy that probably aren't going to do that much good at the end of the day. Again, there's going to be room for debate on this, and because obviously people are all very concerned about this issue. Intruding on people's privacy, you know, more search warrants, more, you know, vetting of people at borders, doesn't necessarily, that's not going to stop people from getting in, because you just need one chink in the armor for somebody to slip through. And that will happen. Ultimately, we've got to go back, just as we have to do with drugs, and start asking, you know, why people want to target us.
You talked on the ability of government to intrude on our rights. There have been many instances already where people of Muslim descent were picked up on pretty thin evidence and have now been set loose after many months in prison.
Yeah, and a lot of trauma.
Yes, and this parallels a lot of the times that people spend in prison awaiting a trial for drug sentencing when, for example, the Dallas Sheetrock scandal, it was a total fraud.
Yeah.
And your thoughts in that regard?
Well, unfortunately, when we cast the net too widely, we hurt a lot of people. That's what we've done with the war on drugs, and we've vilified drug users, and we've demonized them. We've, you know, demonized this, the whole sort of drug milieu, and so anybody who's associated with it, even, you know, just the fact that they're arrested is bad enough. They're tarred and feathered in the public eye, and the same thing is happening with the war on terrorism, that, you know, as soon as somebody is picked up, then we don't think about innocence at that point. We think about guilt. We think they must have done something or they wouldn't have been picked up. And unfortunately, often we're targeting people who are completely innocent. And it's one of the problems. Just as we've had overkill with the war on drugs, we're having overkill with the war on terrorism.
The wars of eternity must be kept alive at any cost. The war of terror is the war on drugs with afterburners. Untrustworthy snitches lead to chemical weapons and eternal wars causing endless and needless hardship, disease, and death. The government attack on the evil ones, mostly people of color, purported to possess these weapons of mass destruction, which threaten our very society, freedoms supposedly fought for are eroded, denied, and held in abeyance till that magical day when all druggies, terrorists, and evil ones are dead, and nobody will ever again use drugs or make a chemical compound not approved by the president. Then we will once again ring the bell of liberty for all.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Chest pain, fever, gastroenteritis, rectal hemorrhage, vaginal hemorrhage, ulcerated stomatitis, pancreatitis, pneumonia, amnesia, decreased libido, neuropathy, deafness, thrombocytopenia, paralysis, and slow death. Time's up. You should have gotten this one. It's the world's number one selling drug to cut down on cholesterol. Lipitor, another FDA-approved product. Head of the Congressional Black Caucus, U.S. Representative John Conyers.
The point is that if we really stand for any of these constitutional phrases that ring across this country and down through history, we have to bring some moral high ground and some integrity to the table. I mean, we can't keep talking the talk and not walking the walk. And of course, more and more people are realizing that around the world, if there are a half a dozen nations in the family of nations on the planet that would take President Bush's word at anything, I would sure like to know who they are.
The man who has been selected to do the most in this battle against terror is the new designate to head up the CIA, Mr. Porter Goss. Is he qualified? Well, let's ask him.
I couldn't get a job with CIA today. I am not qualified. I don't have the cultural background, probably, and I certainly don't have the technical skills. So the things that you need to have, I don't have.
So is there a direct tie between the war on drugs and the war of terror? Let's ask U.S. Representative Henry Hyde, here testifying before a U.S. Congressional Committee on Terror.
DEA had received multi-source information that bin Laden has suspected involvement in the financing and facilitation of heroin trafficking activities. According to the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, opium production accounts for over 50% of Afghanistan's gross domestic product, generating an estimated $2 billion annually in economic activity. The Afghan government believes that 30% of families are involved in some form of opium cultivation and production.
Doesn't that give you just a warm and fuzzy feeling? Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, sees things just a little bit differently. I spoke to you recently about the fact that I see many parallels between the mechanisms of the war on drugs and the war of terror, and one that I find especially egregious is the situation of snitches, untrustworthy snitches like Mr. Shalaby, who led us into the Iraqi war.
There are very big differences regarding informants in criminal cases who are trying to avoid mandatory minimum sentences and may lie and implicate others. That kind of snitching is a result of the way the war on drugs is being fought. The use of intelligence sources, or you can call them informants, is critical to the war on terror and must be encouraged. There is always the challenge of making sure that your sources are dependable. And there is the challenge in analyzing what you hear to know what the motives of your informants are. A major problem in espionage is counter-espionage. It is, and counterintelligence, where there is a deliberate effort to spread misinformation to intelligence agencies. To try to draw parallels between intelligence gathering that is necessary to find terrorists who have perpetrated heinous acts or who are planning others is completely different than the way in which snitches operate in the criminal justice system. I don't think there's a comparison.
All right, well, fair enough. Do you see any direct parallels between the two wars of eternity?
One has to distinguish between the demonstrable danger that terrorists create practically every day. I mean, you can look at the situation in Russia as we speak. You can look at the situation in Israel. You can see, you know, bombing attacks, you know, in Indonesia or in Morocco, in Argentina, in France, as well as the United States. Terrorists are a real threat. Drug users are not a real threat. War on drugs is a political construct and a cultural construct that is completely different. The war on drugs, because of its cultural power, has been used as a place to experiment or seek special law enforcement techniques. And the emotional power now attached to our war against terrorism as a result of 9/11 has meant that members of Congress and government agencies are willing to exceed the constitutional traditions and restrictions in new approaches to try to apprehend terrorists. That's, I think, the extent of the parallel. You know, one of the other questions, obviously, is to what extent is there a connection between terrorists and the illicit traffic in drugs? Are terrorists financing themselves through drug sales? And it is, of course, hypothesized that this is some new phenomenon, some very new danger. When I was in Peru more than 20 years ago, the Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path guerrillas, were financing themselves through taxes on the coca growers, just as today the FARC in Colombia and the right-wing paramilitaries, the AUC, finance themselves taxing coca growing. Prohibition gives opportunities to raise money, and terrorists need money. But it looks like most of the evidence is that terrorists get their money from kidnapping, from other kinds of fraud, I mean, even from cigarette hijacking. After 9/11, most of the reports showed that the Al-Qaeda terrorists got their money from a whole variety of crimes, none of which was drug trafficking.
The one thing that still concerns me, I appreciate this discussion, but it seems to me at times that this is just another means of creating a pork barrel, that much of this work is unneeded and just an unnecessary expense to the taxpayer.
Dean, I agree. There's no question that lots of what's being done in the name of Homeland Security is pork barrel or war profiteering, if you want to call it that. Lots of pointless expenditures are being made by government agencies, and there are numerous businesses lining up eagerly to become contractors to do one pointless thing or another. And that is not unlike what happened, you know, during the heyday of the war on drugs in the 1980s and 90s, where people, you know, eagerly sought to make a profit off the war on drugs. There is a similarity, which is that the over-the-top thinking that we saw regarding the war on drugs, anything is justified if it will save one child from becoming a drug addict, is the same kind of anything is justified if it will stop one terrorist, without sort of having a real sense of what is the real cost, what is the real benefit. You know, we don't have an infinite number of resources we can sort of dedicate to this. We have to do it intelligently. And there's a way in which there is a panic, like the war on drugs, that sort of influences how decisions are being made.
U.S. Representative Dan Burton.
I don't think that Al Capone would have been the menace to society that he was if he couldn't sell alcohol on the black market, and he did, and we had a horrible, horrible crime problem. Now, the people that are producing drugs over in Southeast Asia and in Colombia and every place else, they don't do it because they like to do it. They do it because they're making money. And the problem, in my opinion, is that at some point we have to look at the overall picture.
So do we have the proper people in place to look at the big picture, to manage this war of terror? Let's ask Judge James P. Gray, who's currently running for a U.S. Senate seat in the state of California.
Our present Attorney General, the leader of the Department of Justice, John Ashcroft, is one of the most dangerous people in our country today. What he is doing with regard to the Constitution should cause concern, deep concern, for everyone in the United States of America.
For those listening in California, you can learn more by visiting JudgeJimGray.com.
There's a lot of flag burners who have got too much freedom and want to make it legal for policemen to beat them, cause there's limits to our liberties. At least I hope and pray that there are, cause those liberal freaks go too far.
Best I can tell, our choices this year for president are between a rock and a hard place. Here to talk about that is former DEA agent and author of Powder Burns, Cele Castillo.
I have postulated this thought that many of the mechanisms of the war on drugs are the same in the war on terror. Your thoughts, please.
Absolutely. Our government has recently accused anybody who now smokes marijuana supports terrorism. And in fact, we have never really had a war on drugs, never will. We have more drugs today than we did 15 years ago, and yet we spend billions of dollars in source countries like Colombia and Peru, and we can't even make a dent. And recently our drug wars are stated that we are not making any progress in Colombia. Well, you know, we're losing our civil liberties, and in reality, the war on drugs and the war on terrorism is a war against civil liberties, and we are losing that every day that we continue with this follies. And the facts of the Iran-Contra investigation in the early 87s and is very well known to be the cover up of the Republicans. So it's a farce. It's going to get worse before it gets better, if it gets better.
For more than 172 years, one organization has been responsible for educating more U.S. presidential candidates than any other. Skull and Bones, purveyors of fine opium products since 1832.
First rule of Skull and Bones, there is no Skull and Bones. Both candidates running for president this year are members. Eight major corporations on Wall Street are owned primarily by members of Skull and Bones. Oil companies controlled by Skull and Bones include Standard Oil Trust, Shell Oil, Creole Petroleum, and Pennzoil. Skull and Bones members in the current Bush administration: William H. Donaldson, Robert McCauley Jr., Rex Cordray, Edward McNally, James Boasberg, Evan Galbraith, George Herbert Walker III, U.S. Ambassador to Hungary, James McGregor, Victor Ashe, Roy Austin, David Wiseman. What seems to be clear is that this secret organization has its little hands in everything from Wall Street to the White House, and this year it will win the election, regardless of which candidate we choose. Many of these U.S. politicians are much scarier than any terrorist. As always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please, be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Jam dancing on the edge of an abyss.